I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Does any of that sound familiar? Our guest, Robert Provine, is an expert in the mundane behaviors we do every day, things like yawning and sneezing, scratching, laughing, and crying. He's also an authority on things we do but we don't talk about much, things like belching, vomiting, even flatulence. Provine has written a book about why humans do these things, and it's titled Curious Behavior. He's a professor of psychology and assistant director of the neuroscience program at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He's written dozens of papers on developmental neuroscience and the neural mechanisms of behavior. And Robert Provine, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be with you. It sounds like you had a busy morning in the studio.
We had a very busy morning in the studio. Was it your idea to include a whoopee cushion with your new book?
No, it wasn't. But seems like a good idea to me because it prompts us to think about things that we all talk about, we all think about, that have scientific significance, but no one's really done much about.
Well, you call this small science, and that, I don't think that denigrates the science at all. It's the science of everyday behavior.
Yes, when we think about science, we often think about giant space telescopes, Mars rovers, the Human Genome Project, but we neglect the low-hanging fruit that's available to us all if we know where to look and what to do. And such research requires a low budget. My undergraduate students have done most of the work. And, even high school science fair students can do real science if you look at the right kind of behaviors.
And how did you get interested in these behaviors?
Well, for many years, I'd looked at the mechanisms of behavior using animal models, such as chick embryos, rats, mice, birds of various kinds, because there was a presumption if you wanted to get down to the neurological nitty-gritty, you couldn't do this with humans because of the overlay of cognition and consciousness and language. You had to resort to animal models. But if you know where to look, you can get the same kind of powerful analysis from looking at human behavior. You don't have to resort to animal models.
You write in the introduction to your book, we are part of a human herd whose behavior is often the involuntary playing out of an ancient neurological script that is so familiar that it goes unnoticed.
We're not conscious of the times that we're not conscious. And as a result, we overestimate ourselves as rational, conscious beings who are in total control of our behavior. But very often we're not. Perhaps most of the time we're not. For example, when you decide to, when you yawn, when you see someone else yawn, you don't decide, I want to do what that person over there just did.
Right.
When you laugh along with others, you don't decide, I want to laugh just like they're laughing. We just do these things. And it reminds us that we are neurologically programmed beasts of the herd. We just neglect these aspects of our being that don't put us on a high pedestal.
Well, what you're really also saying is that we are social creatures, and whether it's yawning or perhaps laughing, these are the ways that we are communicating with each other.
Yeah, and it binds us together. For example, when we yawn, when others yawn, this would signal bedtime. We cough when others cough, which may signal that it's a good thing to do this. Because if one person is having respiratory distress, others might also. We laugh when others laugh to bind us together as members of a group. So these unconscious behaviors just aren't quirks. but they're adaptive and contribute to our emergence as a social species.
Well, let me talk more in more detail about yawning, and you have a whole chapter on this. And I have to say, even reading over my intro and going through my notes in preparation for our interview today, I think I yawned about 5 or 6 times in the, you know, getting ready for the interview. So even though you and I weren't talking yet, just the fact that I was reading my notes made me yawn.
Yeah, we actually had looked at that. Virtually everything having to do with yawns triggers yawns, including us talking about it on the radio this very minute. Thinking about yawning triggers yawns. Reading about yawning triggers yawns. Seeing other people yawn triggers yawns. Hearing other people yawns trigger yawns. So it's very, very contagious. You know, in ways, for example, hiccuping's not contagious. Sneezing's not contagious. Fortunately, farting's not contagious, except among certain young boys.
Yes, I remember those young boys. But you also say you can't, as much as yawning is contagious, you also say that you cannot yawn on verbal command.
Yes, this is true also of laughter and crying. One of the reasons why I studied a variety of different such behaviors in my book and in my research was looking at one informs the other. It's like when you have several pieces of the puzzle in place, it helps you to appreciate the other pieces and where they go.
I was always told about yawning that it was either you were bored or you were tired or you needed some kind of fresh air, and that was the explanation for why you were yawning. Does any of that hold up?
Well, some of it does. After all, these are behaviors that have been contemplated since antiquity, going back to Plato and Aristotle. And it's important that we respect folklore about these things, because sometimes the folklore is correct. When we put it to the test, we found that we do yawn more when we're sleepy. Most yawning occurs just after waking up in the morning and before bedtime at night. We do yawn more when we're bored, as opposed to when we're alert. But there were also some surprises. For example, sometimes we yawn when we're anxious and very not bored. For example, athletes before a big event in the Olympics may yawn. Concert performance before the performers before they go onto the stage to perform a concerto may yawn. These people are certainly not bored. Also, we found that one of the age-old explanations about why we yawn is it's due to a buildup of carbon dioxide in the blood or brain, or it's due to a shortage of oxygen. When we put this to a test, we found that it's not true. So it's important to test these things, because if you confirm them, of course, people are going to say, why are you wasting your time confirming the obvious? But it's important to do this, because sometimes there are surprises.
Well, I'm curious about why athletes or, let's say, a violinist before a concert or a game, why would they yawn then?
Well, I think the best explanation is we yawn at times of transition. You know, when we're going from sleep to wakefulness or wakefulness to sleep. Sometimes when we go from being bored to being alert, it could be due to a change in temperature. That's one thing that yawning episodes are associated with, is some sort of change in your behavior. So yawning may be able to account for a lot of these apparently disparate results by being a massive behavior that brings about these changes. It stirs up our physiology.
You write about the closed nose yawn, the clenched teeth yawn, the sealed lips nose yawn, the eyes open yawn, and something called doomsday yawn. What is doomsday yawn?
Okay, well, a doomsday yawn, the concept of this from a Monty Python skit.
I think I know where you're going.
The doomsday joke was so potent that at least in its weaponized version, you couldn't mix the punchline was the setup until the battlefield situation, because otherwise it would put you in a fatal state of laughter. I was wondering if there's a doomsday yawn, you know, where you could engineer a yawn a stimulus that was so potent that you couldn't resist its power. Actually, we started to leave this after coming to understand that we already have a doomsday yawn. Is virtually anything having to do with yawns, including us talking about it, triggers it. Now, so my excitement about pursuing the doomsday yawn was diminished. But it's informative, pursuing, of what would constitute a super yawn. And here we found some surprises. You know, if you think about what makes you yawn, you say, well, seeing another person yawn. And the thing that you think most about it is the gaping mouth. But when we put this to the test, we found that the gaping mouth didn't trigger any more yawns than a smile.
Hmm.
The reason is a gaping mouth is also associated with yelling, with singing, with stretching, with other things that aren't yawns. So if you edit out the gaping mouth from a face of a yawning person, it's just as potent as when the mouth is there. Where if you show the mouth all by itself, it doesn't stimulate many yawns because you don't know what it is. So it turns out that tilting back of the head, the squinting of the eyes, things like this are important. Some of those other behaviors that you mentioned, or modified yawn variants, are informative, and they're the kind of things that anyone can do, including school children for their science projects. For example, when you start to yawn, you can say, can you yawn through clenched teeth, whereby you can inhale or exhale through your teeth? Well, the answer is you can inhale or exhale through your teeth, but the yawn is blocked. So the execution of the yawn requires you to stretch the jaw. Then we have the nose yawn, or sealed lips yawn. If you seal your lips together when you feel a yawn going on, most people find that they can't yawn through the nose. So unlike ordinary breathing, it makes a difference where you do it. You can breathe equally well through mouth or nose, but when you yawn, you must yawn through the mouth. It doesn't work through the nose. Also, if you feel a yawn coming on, you can block it by propping your eyes open with your fingers. So doing that and clenching your teeth sort of stops a yawn in its tracks. Well, all of these things give us insights into the physiological mechanism of the yawn.
So the idea of propping your eyes open will prevent one from yawning. I'm going to try that.
Of course, when you unprop your eyes, you're going to go on. Also, that's a way of blocking sneezes, which is a kind of inevitable act. When you feel a sneeze going on, you're pretty much going to sneeze. But you can at least hold it off by you propping your eyes open.
Well, Robert Provine, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. He's a professor of psychology, assistant director of the neuroscience program at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and he's got a new book called Curious Behavior, and it's subtitled Yawning, Laughing, Hiccuping, and Beyond. Yes, indeed, that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Live Nation is proud to support WHYY. February 16th, international singer Sarah Brightman comes to the Tower Theater. Tickets and information online at livenation.com and thetowerphilly.com.
I'm Marty Moscoen. It's the membership campaign here at WHYY, and do I have an offer for you. Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist who's a colleague at WHYY designed a special Radio Times 25th anniversary mug. It's very cool, it's very clever, and it's yours for a pledge of just $60. So pick up the phone and make a call right now at 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks for listening to Radio Times, and thanks for making that call.
Scott Arboretum's Fall Festival supports WHYY and presents author David Culp launching his book, The Layered Garden, on Sunday, October 21st at 4 p.m. The book is about the layering of Brandywine Cottage and the lessons David learned from 20 years of gardening there. The presentation will be about the collaborative effort his garden has been over the years and personalities that have shaped both the garden and David's life. More information at 610-328-8025 or scottarboretum.org.
Supporting WHYY, Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages, like their sweet and tart hibiscus cranberry juice. Locations and more at TraderJoe's.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about yawning and sneezing and burping and scratching and laughing. And our guest is Robert Provine, again, the author of a new book called Curious Behavior, Yawning, Laughing, Hiccuping, and Beyond. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Robert Provine, another contagious behavior that you write about is laughter. And I think it's pretty true that when we hear laughter, we are in many ways inspired to laugh. I'm thinking about laugh tracks on television programs, the idea of a communal laugh. Why is laughing contagious?
Well, laughter, first of all, we should consider what it is. Laughter is literally the sound of play. And if we explore its evolutionary origins, we find that the ha-ha of modern laughter really evolved from the pant-pant, the sound of labored breathing, of rough-and-tumble play of our primate ancestors. So it's a signal that we send to other people that we're playing. This is fun. And when we laugh along with other people, it's a part of this hardwired social bonding experience. You laugh with your friends, family, lovers, but you may, laughter can also be dangerous.
Yes.
Something that we direct to people, the out group. For example, being laughed at means you better shape up, and it can even be dangerous. So, a surprise to moderns, but not the ancients, is that laughter is not associated with only good times, but also some of the worst of human times.
And it's interesting the subtle difference between laughing with and laughing at, and how laughing at does have that tone of condemnation.
Yeah, we give it another name. When we laugh at, we call it jeering or ridicule. And we need to remember that laughter is a crude instrument, and we don't speak laughter the way we speak. That we're speaking to each other right now. When you laugh, you don't speak ha-ha, it just happens. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you ask people to laugh, most people say, well, I can't laugh just because you asked me. And then you ask them to do it, it'll be sort of like, well, ha-ha-ha. Not very convincing.
No.
So our life is filled with laughter, but we don't speak it, just as we don't speak crying. You know, for example, you ask someone to cry, you know, they can't cry on command. So, you know, the human existence is filled with these sounds that we can't produce on command, but they're there.
Unless one is a very, very good actor who obviously can do all of that. You also write about this weird event that happened in 1962 in Tanzania, and there was this contagious laughter that went on for, what, a couple of years?
You know, this was covered by the World Health Organization, also the front page of the New York Times, a laughter epidemic. It started with some middle school age girls in a boarding school, and one started to laugh and others started to laugh along. And it became so overwhelming that they actually had to send the kids home from school. And the epidemic came and went over some period of time. It seems to be very weird. But we need to remember that we also share a small measure of this anytime we sit in an audience and laugh along with other people. This is a kind of mini epidemic. And we've probably all experienced laughing fits where you start to laugh and you can't stop. This is a common fare in television station Christmas parties where they share some of these blooper reels.
Right.
You really can't stop it. So you don't start it on command. You can't stop it on command. It only may make it worse. But this is, again, a reminder that there's these important behaviors that are not under conscious control.
Well, you know, and I have to admit that I have sometimes laughed with people hysterically at funerals. And these are even funerals of people I have loved, you know, my whole life. But it has felt in many ways like a very cleansing, bonding experience. And do you think that's unusual?
No, it's not unusual. But it's important to remember that when you laugh in situations like that, you're laughing in the presence of other people.
Yes.
In our studies, we found that laughter is really about relationships, not jokes. In fact, maybe only 10 or 15% of laughter follows anything remotely like a joke. But we laugh 30 times more often in the presence of other people than when alone. So if you're laughing at a funeral, you're still laughing in the presence of other people. What would be unusual is sitting in a room by yourself and laughing.
And again, we're talking with Robert Provine about some interesting and everyday human behavior, including laughing and yawning. And he's got a new book called Curious Behavior. And we have a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Rod from Reading to join us on Radio Times. And Rod, go ahead. You're on the air.
Is that Rod you're asking for?
That's you we're asking for. Go ahead, Rod.
Yes, thank you. I wondered if your guest knew that if you're not tired, if you don't have fatigue, there's no need to yawn. I spent 6 months in a meditation retreat in Europe some years ago, and I didn't notice it until I came home and I saw someone yawn, and I said, my goodness, I haven't seen that happen for months. And it didn't inspire me to yawn at all because I was just completely free of fatigue from the months of rest that I'd had. But then, you know, some weeks later, I started to yawn myself again after months of not yawning.
That's fascinating, Rod. Let me see what Robert Provine says. Your thoughts about that?
Well, yawning yawning occurs in a number of different stages, conditions. Yawning may be associated with fatigue and boredom, but not always. So yawning can occur in a lot of different situations physiologically, as well as seeing someone else yawn. It could be that, you know, if you are strongly attuned to some object or task of medication, that may block it.
Rod, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me just ask you a little bit about tickling, and then I do want to move on to some other behaviors that you write about as well. And I think anyone that has tried this knows that you can't tickle yourself. Why is that? Why can't we do that?
Well, that's the critical starting point of understanding tickle, a point that was first pointed out by Aristotle, but I think he didn't fully understand its ramifications. So in tickle, it's one of these many human behaviors that's much broader and deeper than we think. Now, first of all, it's not a simple reflex, because anyone can give you a knee-jerk reflex that takes another person to tickle. You can't tickle yourself. And the reason for this is that you block out self-produced stimulation. So by examining the physiological mechanism of tickle, we also define what constitutes other, another person, and also what constitutes physiologically selfhood. So when we understand tickle, we can define one of the deepest and most important issues in philosophy and science, the criterion for self and other.
The kind of I-thou relationship?
Yeah, the I-thou relationship, and also suggest how we can program more sophisticated robots. So, for example, if you can program a robot to cancel out self-produced stimulation, this allows the important distinction between touching something and being touched, and also may incidentally be a step toward programming personhood into robots.
I want to make sure I understand this. So you're saying the idea that a robot could tickle itself?
Well, the robot, an unsophisticated robot could tickle itself.
Right.
But if you program a robot whereby it cancels out self-produced stimulation, this means that you have to understand how to program other, you know, something that's not yourself. And so this will be a means of programming better motor control into robots as well as programming personhood. So this is a step toward the exciting, I think, philosophical adventure of machine personality.
Interesting. Let me see what Sean from Philadelphia has to say. And Sean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
I just have a quick question for your guest.
Sure.
And I'm sorry to go back a few minutes, but you were talking about laughing at funerals and when we laugh. And at one point, he said something about laughing by yourself. Well, that's a whole different story. And I just, because I laugh when I'm by myself and watching a film or something like that. And I was just wondering, maybe it was just the way I heard it. It sounded, well, that's a whole different story.
Well,
so, I don't know. Is that very strange?
Well, Sean, I'm glad you called. Go ahead, Robert.
In fact, that's an excellent question, and I'm glad you brought it up. Because when you laugh, when you hear people in the radio, you're laughing at the people in the box. Or when you see people on television, you're laughing at the people in the box. Or when you think about past life events or read about them, you're laughing at the people in your head. But if you eliminate the impact of media, if you eliminate what I call vicarious social stimulation, laughter virtually disappears. So that 30 times difference between social and solitary laughter involves the exclusion of media.
Sean, I hope that helps, and thanks for calling into Radio Times. Another thing you say in your book, Robert Provine, is that, and I'll quote here, I will close with a brief comment about what laughter is not. It is not a medicinal procedure for body and soul. The idea that laughter is good for us has become so pervasive that we neglect the fact that laughter, like speech and vocal crying, is a vocalization that evolved to shape the behavior of other people. And I guess the idea that that you can use laughter to heal oneself, you're throwing a lot of hot water or cold water, I guess it is, on that idea.
Yeah, I don't want to come off as a total curmudgeon because obviously laughter feels good when we do it. Laughter is associated with some of our best times. But the point I'm trying to make, and I think it needs to be made strongly, because in our current society, the message is so pervasive that we can laugh ourselves to health and so on. I simply wanted to make it clear that laughter, like speech, is a sound evolved to change the behavior of other people, not to make ourselves healthy. So the health benefits of laughter would be a secondary consequence of, again, this behavior-changing role.
The idea that you could watch Marx Brothers movies and it might cure your flu or something.
Well, I think it'll certainly make you feel better, and
yes,
it may, in fact, have an analgesic property that blocks pain. So there's certainly benefits, but there are secondary benefits, and some of the benefits associated with laughter may be associated with the social context in which laughter occurs, the presence of friends, family, lovers.
Well, let's go from laughing to crying. Obviously, different kinds of crying, and I think children cry without a second thought. I think for adults, they mostly control their crying as best they can. How should we understand what crying is?
Well, crying makes a nice contrast with laughter, as they're both inborn, instinctive human vocalizations. And just as we see the ancient Greek mask of comedy and tragedy, I think when we consider their physiology, this is informative also. So crying, like laughing, can't be performed on command. Both of them are contagious. You know, just as we laugh when we hear other people laugh, at least babies cry when we hear other babies cry. Laughter is also a faster vocalization. We have ha ha ha. We're chopping an outward breath, with each ha being about a 15th of a second. That's repeated about every fifth of a second, like ha ha ha, as opposed to crying, for example, which has the duration of a single breath cycle, such as whoa, you know, a sound like that. But again, they're both herd behaviors. They're both instinctive. We don't have to learn them. While in adults, crying is fairly rare. Laughter is maintained at high levels through adulthood.
I have to admit that I'm a bit of a crybaby. And if, you know, when I go to the movies and I'm totally engrossed in the story and something sad or moving happens, I'm crying, you know. I'm there crying in my seat.
Well, two things are going on when you cry. First of all, crying is a care solicitation vocalization that's unconscious. For example, crying is sending out this ancient instinctive message that you need help. When you're doing it, you're also producing tears. And while crying is common throughout the animal kingdom, or the mammal kingdom, tears are unique to humans. For example, emotional tears, when you show them, only humans do it. Our closest relatives, the chimpanzees, can't. And the tear plays an important role in communicating sadness. For example, we did studies whereby we digitally edited out images of tears from apparently sad, teary faces. And we did this. The faces often no longer look sad. Sure. So tears contribute to the nuance and emotional valence of perceived faces. Tears help communicate and fine-tune social communication.
Let me get I'm sorry, let me just jump in here because only we have Dennis from Westchester, and I think he wants to speak to exactly what you're talking about, Robert. Dennis, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
Doctor, my question is, I heard somewhere or read that when we cry, that our tears actually excrete certain chemicals or proteins or some kind of a substance that actually does make us physically feel better, as in the expression, have a good cry. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
You're welcome, Dennis. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Robert Provine, go ahead.
Okay, good question. In fact, the notion that, you know, a good cry will make us feel better actually has a rather weak support in that crying can actually make you feel sadder. But what is crying doing, at least, you know, the production of tears, is one explanation is that the tears may rid our body of certain substances, hormones or minerals that may help us balance mood or physiology. Now, that's an interesting proposition, but it's limited by the amount of tears produced. A crying, tearing episode only produces about 1 milliliter of tears. You know, so I think we should contrast that with the potential remedial measures of drooling or urination or something like that. That would be a kind of physiological Niagara compared to what's secreted in tears.
Well, you know what?
Tears also seem to be a sexual turnoff, at least to men. A study in Israel had been done whereby it had been shown that males have a de-aroused sexuality. And when they sniff women's tears.
Well, you know what? Hold on to that thought, because we are all ears. We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation, talking with Robert Provine about his new book called Curious Behavior, Yawning, Laughing, Hiccuping, and Beyond. We'll be talking about that beyond after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Widener University supports WHYY and offers graduate degree programs including hospitality and tourism, human sexuality, physical therapy, social work, and more, giving students hands-on leadership experience designed to help advance careers in today's challenging economy. Widener's next open house is on Tuesday, October 23rd from 5 to 7 p.m. More online at widener.edu. Widener University. Widener Leadership Works.
I'm Marty Moscoane. It's the membership campaign here at WHYY, and do I have an offer for you? Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist who's a colleague at WHYY designed a special Radio Times 25th anniversary mug. It's very cool, it's very clever, and it's yours for a pledge of just $60. So pick up the phone and make a call right now at 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks for listening to Radio Times, and thanks for making that call.
Wintertour presents Uncorked, Wine, Objects, and Tradition, now open in the Wintertour Galleries. This exhibit celebrates objects and imagery created in response to society's love of wine. More than 300 British and American wine-related items are on view, illustrating the historic role wine played in the worlds of design, international trade, and social life. Details on lectures, wine tastings, tours, and tickets at wintertour.org. Wintertour supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We've been talking with Robert Provine about some areas of human behavior that he's an expert in, things like yawning and sneezing, laughing and crying. We're going to also talk about things that we mostly don't talk about on this radio program, things like belching and vomiting, even flatulence. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Why? Robert Provine, right before the break, you were talking about tears. Sometimes tears are a turnoff for men when it comes to sexuality. Help us understand that.
Yes, there's yet undefined chemicals in tears that, when sniffed by men, have a de-arousing effect. Men will rate images of women as being less attractive. Chris, this gets back to a point that I think men have long suspected, that tear jerkers aren't good date movies.
but tears do have, as you write about, it seems like they have a kind of sanitizing effect on the eye.
One clear effect, that there's a serious pathology associated with the loss of tears. So obviously, tears are important in lubricating the eye. If you don't have it, you have the condition called dry eye. Right. But in one anecdote that I shared in the book, I had a girl that I met at a scientific conference came up to me and talked about the big problems in her life that were associated with the loss of emotional tears. She wasn't able to tear up when she felt sad. And she felt that she was faced with constantly having to explain to friends why she was behaving the way she was, because her tears couldn't speak for her. So tears play an important role as a visual as well as chemical message to other people. So when you add tears to an otherwise neutral face, it will make it look sad.
Interesting. Let me get Jennifer from Trenton to join our conversation. And Jennifer, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Great, thank you. I'm really interested in this discussion about crying, and particularly I'm interested in your thoughts on happy crying, because I hope this doesn't say anything terrible about me, but I don't cry in a sad movie. I will cry in a happy moment, like when the music surges in Dead Poets Society and the students stand up on their desks for their teacher, or when a performer gets a standing ovation at a concert. Like, I'll cry every time, and I'm just interested in your thoughts on that.
The idea of crying when you're happy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, happy tears. That's an it's an interesting and challenging problem. I was really starting off with simpler problems. Asking what makes a person look happy or what makes a person look sad. But these kind of hybrid emotions, where you have tears of happiness, really don't know. And in fact, that's actually just last night I was thinking and writing about that topic. For example, one of the traits of happiness is having clear whites of the eyes. You know, as opposed to the red eyes of sadness, you have white eyes. But a happy person who is tearful, that they're so overjoyed, may show this redness, which is clearly atypical of most happiness, and will show tears. But then again, tears, like other of these instinctive vocalizations, are rather crude social instruments. For example, we shed emotional tears not only when we're weeping, but also during sneezing, during coughing, during yawning, things that we don't think about. So So what we're looking at are some very crudely tuned tools.
Jennifer, thanks for calling into Radio Times. You have a chapter in your book, Robert Provine, called Farting and Belching. And under the Farting and Belching chapter, you write about this extraordinary Frenchman named Joseph Pujol, or Pujol. He was known, he had a stage name, Le Pentomane. Tell us what his particular talents were.
Well, this is the fartomaniac, who was the hit act of the Moulin Rouge around the turn of the 20th century. Even out-earned Sarah Bernhardt. And his specialty was performances through the rectum.
Wow.
He could perform remarkable feats here, excuse me, such as honking out the melody of the Marseillaise, as well as common tunes of the day, all sorts of sound effects. He was able to do this by using the rectum as kind of bellows. He could actually inhale through his rear and then exhale, setting up vibrations in the anus, you know, vibrating membrane, a vibrating valve. This is interesting, not only because it's entertaining and funny, but it's also informative about understanding the reason that we talk the way we do. As we're conversing with each other, basically we're using the lungs for bellows and not the rectum, and we're setting up vibrations in a valve that originally evolved to keep food and drink out of the airways. Mm. While it may seem more elegant than butt speak, it's not as much more elegant as we might think. So basically, we have adapted this structure, this valve in our throat, the vocal cords, to serve a function that wasn't their original function. So by studying different kinds of sound making, we can understand why we ended up with the process that we have.
I guess the idea of walking on 2 feet and being upright and the impact that that had on the thorax and that leading to all these things that we can vocalize.
Yeah, this was an interesting case where laughter proved to be not only intriguing in its own,
right,
but to provide insights into other things. For example, by studying the evolution of laughter, we got insights into the evolution of speech. So by studying how laughter changed from the ancient primate version, which was panning, I'll give you an example. If you hear a chimp panting or a chimp laughing, it sounds like panting. And that was transformed into the human ha-ha. The reason for the transformation of laughter also indicates the transformation from not speaking to human speech. And it has to do with breath control. The chimps and other primates don't have sufficient breath control to shape the outward breath to produce the kind of virtuosic sounds of speech. And again, laughter provided the cue. And the reason for the transformation seems to be walking upright on 2 legs. When we walk upright on 2 legs, this frees the thorax from the mechanical support function during running, whereby there has to be a one-to-one relationship between forelimb strikes and breathing. Or otherwise, we'd go face first,
sure,
into the dirt.
Sure.
But when we stand upright on 2 legs, we no longer have to coordinate locomotion and breathing, and there can be the subsequent selection for the fancy sounds of speech.
Well, the audience that went to hear Le Pentomane talk, as you described, you know, just writhing in their seats, hysterically laughing, but just to understand his unique talents, he could make the sound of a rooster crowing, a puppy, a dog with its tail caught in the door, a blackbird, an owl, a duck, bees, a tomcat, a toad, a pig, and musical instruments including violin, bass, and trombone. Too bad we couldn't have recorded all that.
Yes, and as I also mentioned in the book, it's a shame that Mozart didn't overlap with Petermann, because Mozart certainly had an enthusiasm for flatulence.
He did.
He might have written a concerto for Petermann.
Oh, my goodness gracious. And whether that would have lived on, who knows? Let's see what Robert from Swedesboro has to say. And Robert, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I was wondering if you had considered that possibly the underlying thread that links all these issues is concentric muscles contracting rhythmically and repetitively, and also linked to strong emotion in the humans, and whether or not this was just a broad group of behaviors and experiences that all have concentric muscles contracting repetitively and linked to strong emotions.
That's interesting. Robert, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Robert Provine, your thoughts?
Interesting idea. One of the reasons that I put a lot of these pieces of the puzzle together in my book was to get people thinking about families of problems and thinking about them in non-traditional ways. For example, what we call emotion is in large part, I think, the gathering together of people and voting about what's officially emotion and what's not. So we're talking about a lot of it's convention. But I think the issue that you brought up about the rhythmic contractions is interesting, especially in the case, for example, of laughing and crying. Infant crying is usually a wah kind of sound, whereby the sound is about the length of an outward breath, you know, a second or so. As opposed to ha-ha-ha of human laughter. But some crying, that we call sobbing, like the boo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo, will have that rhythmic pattern. And I wouldn't be surprised if a common mechanism was related to both of them.
Robert, thanks for calling into Radio Times to see what Aaron from Philadelphia has to say. Aaron, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, hello.
Hi.
I'm calling to discuss my experiences in laughter yoga, which is a series of exercises designed to help simulate laughter and then lead into genuine laughter for a period of about 45 or 50 minutes.
And does it work?
It works. It gives you a euphoric effect and an analgesic effect that lasts for several hours.
Does that make sense to you, Robert Provine?
Yes. In fact, I discuss laughter yoga. And, you know, some of the other brand names of it, I think there's called the World Laughter Tour. And underlying this is the strong contagiousness of laughter. The founder of Laughter Yoga had discovered that, you know, you didn't really need the jokes. The key is basically getting people laughing together. And so what they've tapped is a very strong trait of human nature. One that overlaps with, for example, the Tanganyikan laughter epidemic that we talked about before, the laughter with other people when we sit in the audience of a comedy performance. So clearly, laughter yoga works to synchronize behavior. Of course, the issue about whether or not this is going to have a medicinal effect is another issue. I think it can be entertaining, and it can feel good when we do it. I think it also probably has an analgesic effect, you know, like aspirin is effective in blocking pain. We're still working on the extent to which it has other longer-lasting beneficial medicinal effects.
Aaron, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Robert Provine is our guest. He's a professor of psychology, assistant director of the neuroscience program at the University of Maryland at the Baltimore County. And we've been talking about his new book called Curious Behavior, Yawning, Laughing, Hiccuping, and Beyond. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Robert Provine, you talk about something called a photic sneeze reflex, that some people sneeze in response to light?
Yes. You know, sneezing's an intriguing act. In fact, I even talk about the possibility that the sneeze is a kind of fast yawn, whereby we recruit the mechanisms of one behavior to support another. Sneezing is not under conscious control. You know, we can cough and command, another airway maintenance behavior, but we can't sneeze and command. One of the curious properties of sneezing is that, you know, not only arises from, let's say, something tickling our nose or an irritation in the nose, but amongst certain people, exposure to light. This is the so-called photic sneeze reflex that has previously been considered a mystery. I suggest that it's a kind of what's called a Zeitgeber, a time giver, in human behavior, whereby when, at least amongst certain people, when you see light for the first time in the morning, it will trigger a sneeze and clear the airway. Now, so what we may have is not simply a kind of quirk, but something that's a significant adaptation amongst certain people.
Well, on that note, our thanks to you, Robert Provine, for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And his book is called Curious Behavior. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. We had assistance today from Jonathan Best. And the show was produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. And we do want to close things out with George Carlin. And this is a comedy routine that goes back to 1972, a very famous one. And this is a clip from a routine called Class Clown.
Class clown. Was the first guy to discover this, usually in gym class, right? Yeah. Yeah, the old artificial fart under the arm. Or as we called it in New York, the artificial fart under the arm! There are a lot of ways to make the fart sound when you're a kid. Remember, you had this one, too. And then the crook of your arm. It was an important sound, you know? I guess we found so many ways to make it, you know? I didn't need any of those fancy ones, because I could, I was into the bilabial fricative, you know. I was so glad when I found out that had a real official name to it, man. Bronx cheer and raspberry never made it for me. Bilabial fricative. Do one from the back? It would probably be an SBD today, man. Remember that?
Silent but deadly. Wow.